Well, welcome to the Epic Podcast, and we are at our long-awaited episode 9. This is Numbers 10 to 33 and Deuteronomy 1 to 34. Oh my word, can you believe it? God had done so much for the Israelites. He brought them out of slavery. He gave them a new identity and called them His chosen people, a royal priesthood, and He promised that He would distinguish them from all people by blessing them. He provided everything they needed while they were in the desert, but they were always so ungrateful and just did not learn that He is good and He is faithful. He invited them to come up to the top of Mount Sinai so that He could speak to them directly, but they were afraid and chose rather to hear through a priest. Israel kept messing up. They were so impatient and quick to replace God with a worthless handmade golden calf. This act of idol worship really hurt God, because they were turning to something created by their own hands instead of worshiping the Creator, who loved them, who chose them, and who wanted a relationship with them. They were almost there, but they caved when they saw the giants they would have to face. They were still stuck in their old way of thinking. They weren't learning that it's not by might or power that they would receive this land, but by God's Spirit and His power. They were still trying to do it in their own strength and therefore saw no hope. They truly believed that it was up to them to accomplish it. Despite God's unwavering goodness and faithfulness, they refused to trust Him or to stand firm on all He had already done for them. The miracle at the Red Sea faded in a hazy, distant memory. Because of their unbelief, God decreed that the entire generation of those who had grumbled against Him, aged 20 and older, would not enter the land. Instead, they would wander in the wilderness for 40 years, and only their children, along with Joshua and Caleb, the two faithful spies, would they be allowed to enter the land. Can you imagine, after everything they had been through, they threw away their chance to finally rest and enjoy God's reward, simply because they lacked the faith for that last stretch. They were being sent back to the wilderness, to hardship and depending on God for everything. They would eat only manna and quail for the next 40 years and literally wait to die. This sounds so hopeless, doesn't it? Once again, we cannot fathom God, because He does everything outside of time and with the end goal of reconciling everything to Himself. Life in Jesus is eternal, and God has a perfect plan in the context of eternity. We have to know that God is fair, and that His judgment is fair. His judgment is in the context of His ultimate goal, to restore all things to Himself. In this story, we pick up on their journey in the wilderness during those 40 years until the next generation was ready to carry the baton of the covenant God made Abraham. Folks, when we go through our wilderness season, God teaches us how to eat manna and receive fresh revelation. Just as He wanted the Israelites to learn to live by and be sustained by what He was providing for them, He wants us to be sustained by His word. He wants us to be able to live by His word so that our very life depends on it. His word is not just a list of do's and don'ts, but it is living and relevant and gives us wisdom, guidance and insight to every aspect of our day. God uses this wilderness experience to prepare us for entering the land of our destiny so that we will not be intimidated by the giants and the high walls standing in our way because we would have learned to trust Him. 40 years was a long time, and many things happened before Israel would see the promised land again. While the Israelites had been at Mount Sinai, God told Moses to organize them according to their tribes, so that would be the 12 sons of Jacob, each forming a tribe. Since Jacob's son, Joseph, had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, these two tribes replaced the Levites. And the Levites were chosen to be responsible for the care of the tent of meeting and the ministry, and no one else was allowed to go near where they were. At some stage in the wilderness, a Levite named Korah and certain men from the tribe of Reuben rebelled and rose up against Moses. Remember from the story of Jacob that Levi was one of the two sons that slaughtered the men of Shechem for raping their sister, and Reuben was the eldest son of Jacob that defiled his authority and slept with his concubine. These men and 250 well-known community leaders who had been appointed members of the council came as a group to oppose Moses and Aaron and said to them, "The whole community is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is with them. Why then do you set yourselves above the Lord's assembly?" They were basically challenging God's appointed priests, and they were opposing Moses' leadership, and they accused him of exalting himself above the Lord's assembly. Moses was horrified, and he told them that they should all bring their censers filled with burning incense the next day to the tent of meeting, and so should Aaron. It would be a showdown. The next morning, when they stood face to face, the glory of the Lord appeared to the entire assembly, and Moses yelled, "Move back from the tents of these wicked men. Do not touch anything belonging to them, or you will be swept away because of all their sins." Then Moses said, "This is how you will know that the Lord has sent me to do all these things and that it was not my idea. If these men die a natural death and suffer the fate of all mankind, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord brings about something totally new and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them with everything that belongs to them and they go down alive into the realm of the dead, then you will know that these men have treated the Lord with contempt." As soon as he had finished saying all of this, the ground under them split apart and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them and their households and all those associated with Korah, together with their possessions. They went down alive into the realm of the dead with everything they owned. The earth closed over them and they perished and were gone from the community. The rest of the community were in an uproar and they started blaming Moses and Aaron for the death of all these people. Suddenly the cloud of God's presence covered the tent meeting and his glory appeared. The cloud over the tent was always a sign of God's presence. Moses and Aaron went to the entrance of the tent and the Lord spoke to Moses saying, "Move away from these people so I can destroy them immediately." But Moses and Aaron fell face down, interceding for all the people. Moses quickly told Aaron, "Grab your censer, put incense in it with burning coals from the altar and hurry to make atonement for the people. God's wrath has come upon them and the plague has started." When Aaron offered the incense and made atonement, the plague stopped. But 14,700 people died that day, in addition to those who had perished in Korah's rebellion. These Israelites were just not learning from their mistakes, regardless of the punishment they received. I would be so fed up by now if these were my children. After Korah's rebellion, God was going to settle their dispute once and for all. He said that each tribal leader should bring a staff to the tent of meeting, inscribed with their name. Remember, Aaron's staff represented the tribe of Levi. They placed the staffs in front of the Ark of the Covenant. The next day, Aaron's staff miraculously sprouted buds, blossomed and produced almonds. So Aaron's priestly role and leadership and the role of the Levites was endorsed by God, never to be argued again. God told them to keep his staff in the Ark of the Covenant with the manna and the two stone tablets as a sign to prevent further rebellion. Now we pick up the story of the Israelites in their 40th year of wandering in the desert. In the first month of that 40th year, around 14,006 BC, the Israelites arrived at the Zin Desert and camped at Kadesh, where Miriam, Moses' sister, died and she was buried. Kadesh was the 33rd camp according to Numbers 33. Now this is not the Sin Desert we spoke about last week. It is in the southern part of the land of Canaan, near the Negev Desert, which is in the story of Abraham and Isaac. When they arrived there, they could not find water for the people to drink. Why am I not surprised that the Israelites had something to say about this, and once again they went to Moses and complained about it? Folks, we are not talking about a small group of people here. This group was larger than a million by now, and they needed water for themselves and their animals. How was Moses going to solve this problem? I think 40 years in the desert had taken its toll on Moses, and he was truly fed up by this stage. He had carried their burdens and complaints day in and day out. He had mediated and interceded for them for all their sinful and rebellious behavior. So I want you to imagine the context of what happens next. Moses cried out to God for water for his people, and then God told him to speak to the rock, and the water would be given to them. But Moses was quite irritated by the stage, and instead of listening to God's specific instructions, he called the Israelites rebels, and in anger he struck the rock twice with his staff, yelling, "Must I draw water from this rock?" Like we would say, "Must I draw blood from a stone?" Moses had reacted with an attitude of contempt. Note that God had instructed him to speak to the rock. He did not say strike it, as he had done 40 years ago when they had escaped. Now folks, listen to what happens next. God says, "Because you did not trust me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring in the community to the land I give them." This place was called Meribah. Even though Moses was God's closest friend, he was not exempt from sin. Let's just think about this for a moment. This is hectic. Moses is God's friend. He was designed into God's complex blueprint to rescue the Israelites. Against all odds, he was rescued and shaped for this, and he was anointed with such spiritual weight that God said Moses would be like God to Pharaoh. So powerful was the anointing on his life. He performed miracle after miracle, and he gave himself to the plight of these unbelieving people, praying and begging God not to destroy them. Their 40 years in the wilderness is now nearly over. The promised land is in sight. But in a single moment of fatigue, he acts with contempt and seemingly no faith, as he has forgotten that God would provide water if he simply spoke to the rock. In that moment of indiscretion, he threw away his future. God told him that he would not be able to enter the promised land. This seems really harsh, and one has to feel sorry for him. We don't understand these things, but we do need to realize that we do need to honor God and honor his holiness. We need to keep faith and stand on his promises and actually not question the how and the when, but to know in our knowing that God will do what he said he will do. Folks, I just want to encourage you, if any one of you is feeling tired and burdened and just hopeless, and your wilderness season is being more than you can bear, don't give up. Hold on. Hold fast to what you've heard God say he will do, just as we have witnessed Abraham hold on for his promise. Rest in God's timing and in his wisdom to bring you into the land he promised you and to give you all that you have been waiting for. His promises are closer than you realize. After all this had happened, the Israelites left Kadesh and set out for the promised land via Edom. Edom is the land located southeast of the Dead Sea, in what is today the southern Jordan. Before they arrived at the border of Edom, they stopped at Mount Hor. God told Moses that his brother Aaron would die there and not enter the promised land because of what had happened at Meribah. Moses took Aaron and his son Eleazar up the mountain. Aaron died there at the age of 123 on the first day of the fifth month of the 40th year. Moses removed Aaron's garments and put them on his son Eleazar. So let's see what's happening here. God was preparing the next generation to lead the people into the promised land. He started by passing the mantle of priesthood from Aaron to his son Eleazar, and not before long he was going to pass the mantle of leadership from Moses to Joshua. This would be a new era of leadership. Now the Edomites were supposed to be friendly and accommodating. Edom was Esau's family, who was Jacob's brother. The Israelites were Jacob's descendants, so one would expect Esau's family to help. Moses told the king of Edom that they didn't want anything from him, just a way to pass through to Canaan. But the Edomites absolutely refused to let them pass, and they came out to confront them with a large and powerful army. So the Israelites had to go the long way around Edom and travel south and then travel north on the east side of the Jordan to get to Canaan. On their way, the Canaanites from the Negev tried to attack them, but with God's help, Israel defeated them and the king Arad, despite losing a few of their own men. This last stretch was really difficult and they were quite spent, but they had to keep on fighting to press through for the promised land. It was difficult for them to grumble, even though they knew it would upset God. We can easily fall into this trap of complaining and lashing out when we simply have no reserve left. When we are so tired and worn out by the pressure of facing battle after battle and seemingly day in and day out caught in the wilderness cycle, the pressure just seems to keep piling up. It is always one thing after the next, and together everything is just too much to bear. Our souls are so starved and we need rest. But this is exactly when we are most receptive to God's love and mercy, if we just choose to press in and seek His presence. We need to believe in the deepest place of our soul that He does in fact have our backs and He will not let the enemy win. Life is not about the years we have left on this earth, but God is strengthening us and equipping us to rule and reign in the context of eternity. If we look at Hebrews 11, Abraham obeyed God's call to leave his homeland and trusted in God's promise of an inheritance. We talked about this in episode 2. Yet he lived as a stranger in the promised land, never fully receiving the inheritance during his lifetime. Verse 13 says that Abraham and others died in faith, not having received their promises, but having seen them afar off, and they were assured of them. Their faith was rooted in something greater than the immediate. They looked towards God's eternal promises and heavenly homeland. They trusted in God beyond what they could see in the present. Anyway, God was not going to have any of their moaning, so He sent a plague of venomous snakes which bit and killed many, many people. The Israelites repented and begged Moses once again to intercede for them. Then God instructed Moses to create a bronze snake and place it on a pole. Whoever was bitten could look at the bronze snake and be healed. This story foreshadows the crucifixion of Jesus and His role as Savior. John 3 verses 14 to 15 says, "Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes may have eternal life in Him." Sometime later, when everyone was healed, they were ready to take more territory. They had to confront the Amorites, but with God's help they defeated them and took their territory from Arnon to the Jabbok River. Then they went on to destroy King Og of Bashan, who was the last of Rephaim, a group of giants. Their reputation as a force to be reckoned with spread like wildfire, and before they reached Moab on the east side of the Jordan River, everyone knew that Israel's God was helping them. Now they had reached the plains of Moab. We need to remember that the Moabites are the descendant of Lot, Abraham's nephew, who had an incestuous relationship with his daughter and fathered Moab. Unfortunately, in their waiting in this land, they succumbed to the environment and compromised. The Israelites started adopting the gods of the people around them. They were literally a few months away from entering the promised land, but they were the ones living it, so history had not been made and not yet been documented. They had no idea that their breakthrough was literally around the corner. They were so quick to compromise. Folks, those of us who have walked with the Lord for a while are privileged because we have built a history with God. We have witnessed Him come through for us time and time again. We can trust God because we have experienced His power. We need to encourage our children and new converts and teach them to be patient in building their own history with God. We need to encourage them with our testimonies, and we need to encourage ourselves so that we don't give up because we don't see what is waiting for us around the corner. The next story has captured my attention for many years, and I wrote about it in my book called Crossing the Jordan River, Stepping into Destiny. When I studied this section, I had a revelation of the idea of the tactics of our spiritual enemies for the first time. When the spiritual enemy controlling God's people through the Pharaoh was threatened by the increase of the Israelites, he brought heavier oppression and demanded more from them with less resources. I spoke about this in episode 7. The spiritual enemy operating through the king of Moab is also threatened by the increase of Israelites in his land, and he is afraid of how they destroyed the Amorites. Folks, when we are about to enter our promises, the enemy is nervous of our increased spiritual strength. We have to know this. The way in which we begin to influence the people around us and literally take spiritual ground threatens the prince of darkness. It undermines his influence and control over people. In Numbers 22, the story of the enemy's strategy unfolds. Listen to what the king of Moab does. But remember that Satan is controlling the territory through him. Scripture says, Now Balak, the king of Moab, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was terrified because there were so many people indeed. Moab was filled with dread because of the Israelites. Balak, the king of Moab, sought a desperate solution. He consulted the Midianite priests, and they agreed to hire Balaam, a renowned prophet for hire, and they were going to curse the Israelites. They wanted to bring a negative broadcast, contrary to the heart and intentions of God for his people. They wanted to speak a lie, so to speak, that would dishearten them and make them weak. Balaam agreed to consult the Lord for guidance, but God instructed him not to curse the Israelites because he had blessed them. The next morning, Balaam informed Balak's officials that the Lord had refused to let him go with them. Disappointed, they returned to Balak with the news. Refusing to give up, now listen to this, Balak sent a larger, more distinguished group of officials, promising Balaam great wealth and power if he cursed the Israelites. God knew Balaam's heart, that he would indeed be persuaded if he was paid a lot of money. But he let him go anyway, with strict instructions to say only what God had given him to say. God knew that Balaam would not listen to him and that his intentions were reckless. So when Balaam took off on his donkey to meet Balak, God sent an angel who stood in the middle of the road in the narrowing. There was no place for the donkey to turn left or right. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with a drawn sword in his hand, it took off into the field. Balaam tried to beat the poor thing to get back on the road, but this happened a third time. Then the donkey spoke. The Lord opened the donkey's mouth and it said to Balaam, What have I done to you to make you beat me these three times? Balaam did not even realize until God opened his eyes that there was an angel standing in front of him. And the angel said, I have come here to stop you because the path you are taking is reckless. Can you imagine the scene? I must admit, I wouldn't mind if my dog spoke to me if I was heading down the wrong path. When Balaam reached Barak, he took him up to Bamoth Baal, which means the high place of Baal. When he opened his mouth to speak, God put words in his mouth and made him speak four oracles of blessings over the Israelites. Balaam had initially obeyed God and refused to curse Israel, showing that he could be used by God for his purposes. Yet, as his story unfolded, Balaam's true motivations came to light. This is important because later in the story of Kings, Aram is a powerful enemy against Israel, and here we begin to understand the tactics of the Arameans. Aram is a descendant of Shem, Noah's son. Aram is known as Syria today. So as an Aramean, Balaam is a prophet for hire. His strategy is to curse Israel, to bring a false broadcast, so to speak, using negative speech to demoralize God's people. Let us look at how we can recognize his strategy in our own lives. We need to understand the character of the Moabites and the Midianites, since they often work in tandem with the Arameans. Judges 6 describes how the Midianites, along with the Amalekites and other eastern peoples, oppressed Israel. These groups would invade and steal the Israelites' crops, livestock, and resources during harvest time, leaving the land desolate. This led to severe suffering and poverty for the Israelites. These three groups often work together in our own lives to impoverish us physically and spiritually. Moab and Midian steals from us. These are things that are lost or broken, unexpected tax demands, increased fees, interest rate spikes, investments crashing, car accidents, unexpected bills. This enemy costs us money. Then they work with the Aramean and want us to partner with false broadcasts and lies to demoralize us, bringing hopelessness and depression. And when they can't get that right, they seduce us into idolatry. But we will get to that in a moment. But fortunately, God gives them and us the antidote. He declares blessings, and we are to declare his blessings, his word, and remind the enemy that we are blessed and loved by God. When the Moabites and Midianites realized that their initial plan had failed, we can assume that they offered Balaam additional wealth in exchange for his expert advice. In 2 Peter 2, Balaam is mentioned as someone who loved the wages of unrighteousness, implying that he could be bought, and he would lead others astray for personal gain. He told them to use their woman to seduce the Israelite men into sexual immorality. This would then tempt them to adopt the gods of the Moabites and the Midianites. That is exactly what happened. Some of the Israelite men began to indulge in sexual immorality with the Moabite woman. These women invited them to participate in sacrifices to their gods. And soon, the Israelites were not only eating the sacrificial meals, but also were bowing down to these foreign gods. In this way, Israel bound themselves to the Baal of Peor. God was infuriated with this new generation. Had they not learnt? So he commanded Moses to take action. Gather the leaders responsible for this and expose them in broad daylight before me, so my anger may turn away from Israel. So Moses told them, all those who have yoked themselves to Baal should be killed. And then God inflicted another plague for Israel's sin. Everyone was so upset by this, so they gathered at the entrance of the tent meeting with Moses to mourn Israel's sin. While they were doing this, Zimri from the tribe of Simeon brought Cozbi, the daughter of a Midianite tribal chief, into the camp in broad daylight to have sex with her. He didn't care who saw him. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar and the grandson of Aaron the priest, grabbed a spear and followed Zimri and Cozbi into the tent. Then he drove it through both of them. This decisive act stopped the plague that had been devastating the Israelites, but not before it claimed the lives of 24,000 people. God told Phinehas that he and his descendants will have a covenant of a lasting priesthood because he was zealous for the honor of his God and made atonement for the Israelites. Then God told the remaining Israelites, treat the Midianites as enemies and kill them. After the plague, God told Moses to take a census, which would be the second since they left Egypt. When he was done, Moses went to the top of Pisgah, as God had told him to do, and he got to see the entire promised land that they were waiting for. He had made it, but he hadn't. I think he must have regretted what happened when he struck the rock in anger, because it cost him everything. I also think his heart was filled with joy because it was finally over and he could hand over the baton to someone he loved and trusted, Joshua. Joshua would lead the next generation into Canaan and he would lead them into battle as they claimed their land and drove out the enemies that occupied it. Moses had given everything, more than any man had ever done or would ever do again, except for God himself, when he gave his only son to deliver the world. God designed himself into the blueprint to deliver Israel, not an earthly people called Israel, but a spiritual Israel made up of every tribe and nation, Jew and Gentile. This would be 1,400 years or so later, when his word would become flesh as the man Jesus, fully human, but also fully God. Moses had carried the Israelites. He had interceded for them. He had loved them, and his destiny had been woven into this epic adventure. In the process, the I Am had become his friend, and I'm sure his thoughts drifted to the words recorded as far back as Abraham when God told him, I am your exceedingly great reward. Then the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom is the spirit of leadership, and lay your hand on him. Moses had him stand before Eleazar the priest and the entire assembly and commissioned him in their presence. Moses gave him some of his authority so that the whole Israelite community would obey him. Then Moses addressed the nation of Israel. He reminded the Israelites of all that God had done for them. Then he gave them the principles of godly living. In his third message, he called them to commit their hearts to God. He said, see, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to him and to keep his commands, decrees and laws. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you are not obedient, and if you are drawn away to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day that you will certainly be destroyed. You will not live long in the land you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life, so that you and your children may live, that you may love the Lord your God, listen to his voice, and hold fast to him. Then Moses called for Joshua and said to him in the presence of all Israel, be strong and courageous, for you must go with this people into the land that the Lord swore to their ancestors to give them, and you must divide it among them as their inheritance. The Lord himself goes before you and will be with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. Do not be afraid and do not be discouraged. So Moses wrote down the law and gave it to the Levitical priests who had carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and to all the elders of Israel. Then the Lord said to Moses, these people will soon prostitute themselves to foreign gods of the lands that they are entering. They will forsake me and break the covenant I made with them. Many disasters and calamities will come on them because I will not be with them. And I will certainly hide my face in that day because of all their wickedness in turning to other gods. But for now they had to conquer Canaan. God reassured them. He would go ahead of them like a devouring fire, clearing the path. He would subdue these mighty nations and tear down their defenses. With his help, the Israelites would drive out their enemies. But God warned them, when these nations are defeated, they must not think it was because of their own righteousness. Instead, it was because of the wickedness of those nations that God drove them out. The Israelites were reminded that their victory in the Promised Land was not a reward for their goodness, but it was because he was gracious and because of his judgment on those nations. On the first day of the 11th month of that 40th year since they had left Egypt, Moses blessed the tribes, and then he died on Mount Nebo at the age of 120, never to rest in the Promised Land. What was waiting for this next generation in Canaan? Would it be a land of promise and peace, or a place of struggle, decisions and testing? And how long would it take to drive out their enemies? Or would they settle and compromise just as God had warned Moses? Just as the Red Sea stood as a miraculous marker of transition, a barrier between their past and their future, the Jordan River now loomed ahead. It symbolized their entry point into a new season of divine breakthrough and fulfilled promises. And what about the Jordan River itself? Could it be more than just a geographical boundary? Could it become a profound spiritual marker, not just for Israel's destiny, but for generations of God's people yet to come? A gateway, so to speak, into new seasons of faith and purpose. Would Joshua be able to carry the weight that Moses had and truly lead the people of Israel into victory? Well, folks, we'll have to wait till next week to find out. Be sure to like and subscribe to the YouTube channel to keep up to date with new episodes. And also feel free to share. Let us work together to spread God's story and see the manifold wisdom of our Lord as he reveals his blueprint for the world. My book, The Epic, A Chronological and Visual Guide Through the Old Testament, as well as my first book, Crossing the Jordan River, Stepping into Destiny, is available from Takealot SA. You can log on to my website for more information, that is intuitiveprophetic.co.za. And if you would like your own hardcover, high quality digital copy, you can email me at michellenethlingart@gmail.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also follow me on Instagram, michellenethlingart.